Hannibal, Julius Caesar, and Cleopatra. All names most people have heard. But what do they all have in common? I'm Laura Taylor, and with me is my partner in this podcast, Andrew Hook.
Hello, how are you?
Welcome to Digging Deeper with the Ancients. As I mentioned last episode, which if you aren't familiar with, this is the second part of a three-part series giving an overview of ancient Rome. But if anyone is interested in any more details on any specific situation, please let us know. Contact us and let us know. We are available on all the social medias. And
well, that's not true. We're not on LinkedIn.
Or TikTok, I guess.
We don't have a TikTok page yet.
But...
yeah, so we're on Facebook, we're on Twitter, Instagram. On Facebook and Instagram, we're digging deeper with the ancients. And on Twitter, we're at Digging Deep Pod.
Yeah. You can also contact us via email, diggingdeeperwiththeancients@gmail.com.
All one word.
So in the last episode, we covered the founding of Rome and the Roman Kingdom. This episode will be all about the Roman Republic, which is, in some ways, the most difficult to explain, because it can't be separated by rulers like the kingdom and empire. There were people who were in charge of different aspects of the government, but not much is known about most of them. It is also almost as poorly documented as the kingdom, because historical accounts were not written until much later, and the many wars that took place during this period destroyed whatever records there were. Records from the Republic period consist of simple lists of annual magistrates, with the dates they held office and nothing else. So we're basically just a table, a list and the date they were in office.
Right.
It was the religious records and the texts of some laws and treaties that provided a bare outline of major events. Ancient historians fleshed out this meager factual material with both native and Greek folklore. Over time, historical facts about early Rome often suffered from patriotic or face-saving reinterpretations involving exaggeration of the truth, suppression of embarrassing facts, and just pure invention. As you'll find out, I'll talk about some of those details later. But there's also been some modern inventions related to characters like Julius Caesar.
Well, by modern, you mean not ancient.
Yeah. More modern. And, I mean, there's also... there's still stuff being made up. Yeah. There's still movies coming out with him in it and stuff like that.
But most of them are based off of stories that were told much long after the fact.
Yeah, there's a lot of Julius Caesar in, like, Shakespeare. So.
Well, there's a play called Julius Caesar.
It didn't help that the Greeks didn't take serious notice of Rome until they'd conquered almost all of Italy and were fighting against a Greek city in southern Italy. This was roughly 270 BC. Rome's first native historian didn't start writing until around 210 BC. So we don't have any actual records from Rome itself that involve anything more than just basically a table of dates until 210 BC. And the Republic started in 509 BC.
Yeah, right after the kingdom.
Yeah, exactly. So, like, 300 years without...
The Dark Ages. The pre-Dark Ages.
The ancient Dark Ages. Historical writing at Rome didn't begin until after it had completed its conquest of Italy, had emerged as a major power of the ancient world, and was engaged in a titanic struggle with Carthage for control of the Western Mediterranean. The Roman Republic was a time of geographical expansion, wars, and internal struggles. However, it was also a time when Rome grew as a society, as the Romans benefited greatly from contact with such advanced cultures as the Greeks and Egyptians. The first Roman literature appeared around 240 BC. So this is literature as opposed to historical writings.
Right.
And this was with the translations of Greek classics into Latin. Romans would also eventually adopt much of Greek art, philosophy, and religion. Not all of these influences were positive, though, especially to historians. Because as Romans became more influenced by Greeks, their histories became longer and included more fiction, including speeches, political confrontations, and, well, we really don't know what all is fiction in the later works. A great example of this is a very prominent Roman historian named Livy, whose history is a blend of facts and fiction. Since it is often difficult to separate fact from fiction in his works, and doing so involves personal judgment, modern scholars have disagreed about many aspects of early Roman history, and will continue to do so. What I'm covering, it basically, the facts I'm giving you aren't necessarily agreed upon by a lot of people. So if you've heard other versions, that's not surprising. Because it can be interpreted so many different ways, and some people believe aspects of it. So
you're saying something that was written a long time ago that's probably been translated many times in different languages can be misinterpreted?
Yes.
Wow.
I'm saying that, you know, if someone were to watch one of our historical movie, say Troy, and write based, like, do you think that's entirely 100% accurate?
Well, yeah, Brad Pitt was in ancient Greece.
But that's kind of part of what this podcast will do, right? It's, we're trying to show where fiction alters history. But like with our podcast for the MCU versus Norse mythology, it's about how the MCU has altered
picked and choosed what they wanted to use, yeah, and altered things that they wanted a little bit different.
Exactly. And that has been going on for thousands of years. Even the Romans were doing it. Anyways, the Roman Republic was prominent from 509 until 27 BC, which is 500 years. Although many say the Republic ended when Caesar was murdered in 44 BC, since the period that existed between then and Augustus becoming the first emperor of Rome was a time of great political turmoil. So there was a time, let's see, like almost 20 years, mm-hmm, where there wasn't any one strong government or ruler for Rome. There was just so much infighting among the upper politicians that, yeah.
But until there was an emperor, you can't call it the empire.
Yeah, exactly. Until Augustus officially became the emperor.
Yeah. So, yeah.
But that's why there's this period of time.
To heck with those guys.
During this time, Rome's authority and area of control extended to cover great areas of Europe, North Africa, and West Asia. Again, I will try to find maps to put, or at least a map to put on my, at least on Facebook. According to ancient tradition, as soon as the Romans had expelled their last tyrannical king, Rome was attacked and besieged by the king of a nearby Etruscan city, Lars Porsena. Rome was gallantly defended by Horatius Cocles. Sorry if I'm saying the name wrong.
I'm sure he's not going to assume it.
Yes, anything. But there are people who... I'm one of those people who sometimes if I hear names pronounced wrong, I will be correcting it in my head.
Oh, yeah, me too.
So just, you know.
I've yelled at podcasts.
Yes, I apologize to those people if I'm saying names wrong or places. So Rome was gallantly defended by Horatius Cocles, who sacrificed his life in defense of the bridge across the Tiber, and another person who attempted to assassinate Porsena himself in his own camp. When arrested before accomplishing the deed, he demonstrated his courage by voluntarily burning off his right hand in a nearby fire. As a result of such Roman heroism, Porsena was supposed to have made peace with Rome and withdrawn his army. Well, that's a nice little story. But what really happened?
I don't know. I wasn't there.
Nobody really knows, but...
Well, the people who were there knew, but they can't tell us anymore.
No. One prevalent modern view is that the monarchy in Rome was terminated through military defeat and foreign intervention. This theory sees Rome as a site highly prized by the nearby Etruscans, who are known to have extended their power and influence at the time across the Tiber into areas occupied by Latins. Toward the end of the 6th century, Rome may have been involved in a war against King Porsenna, who defeated the Romans, seized the city, and expelled its last king. However, before Porsenna could establish himself as monarch, he was forced to withdraw, leaving Rome kingless. In fact, Porsenna is known to have suffered a serious defeat at the hands of the combined forces of the other Latins and some nearby Greeks, rather than restoring Tarquin, the last king of Rome, from exile to power. The Romans replaced the kingship with two annually elected officials. That's a little more likely, but it still involves the King Porsenna.
Mm-hmm. But if I remember correctly from the last one, even the kings were elected.
Well, this is a king from another city, an Etruscan king who went to Rome, took it over, but before he could really set himself up as ruler, the other surrounding groups of cities around the area came and kicked him out.
Okay. And then they kind of came together and made their own little group of leaders.
Well, and then the Romans themselves managed, they established their own different government than a kingdom. So, a new government. Initially, the consuls possessed all of the king's power in the form of two men elected for a one-year term, which is why it's difficult to describe the time period based on rulers, because 500 years of two rulers, one year at a time, is a lot of people.
Yep.
And that's just the highest level of government.
But could they serve more than one term?
They weren't supposed to.
Oh, okay.
That doesn't mean it didn't happen. Now, these two people could... Sorry, I shouldn't say people. It was always men. They could veto each other's actions. Later, the consuls' powers were broken down further by adding other magistrates that each held a small portion of the king's original power. So it got better over time. Started out basically a kingdom, but with two people, and then over time they separated the powers more. Now, I originally had a bunch of information about the various roles, from the consuls to the popular assemblies and the tribunes, but it's just too much for this podcast, and unless you're really interested in the specific workings of the Roman Republic, it's very boring. However, if you are interested in that, I encourage you to do a bit of research yourself regarding how the king's power was divided during the Republic, or contact us and let us know so that I can plan a future podcast regarding that, maybe. For now, though, I feel most people probably aren't interested in it, so I won't go into great detail. Are you interested in all the details?
Maybe.
Well, I'll go over what I have.
I get overwhelmed a lot. To be honest, I learn a lot more during the editing process.
That makes sense, because then you're actually listening to me. Listen to this through, and then tell me if you're interested in more details, because I do have to go over some politics, right? The consuls, though elected by the people, were drawn largely from the Senate, so similar to the kings before them.
Mm-hmm.
The Senate was dominated by the patricians, which were descendants of the original senators, also known as the privileged class or nobility. Politics in the early Republic was marked by a long struggle between patricians and plebeians. And the plebeians, or plebs, a lot of people will have heard the term plebs, were the common people. Part of the reason why the consuls were almost always patricians was because their primary role was to lead the Roman military, so they were often generals elected by the centuriate assembly. That is, the Roman army organized into a voting body. The highest levels of the Roman military were always patrician, and wouldn't you figure they held the most pull in the voting body, even though they made up only a fraction of the members, just like among civilians.
So you're saying the top 1% are the people that have the most power even then?
Oh, yeah.
Oh.
It was actually probably worse in a lot of these cases.
It was the top 0.5%.
Yeah. And yeah, now our politics are at least, they are more...
Well, because there's a lot more of them.
Yeah, they are more fair than they were, which is hard to believe, but yes. but they also the bribery and buying your way into positions was very common back then too, which is why there were almost never plebs or plebeians. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right.
Either way.
But in higher level positions, because unlike modern militaries where you work your way up in rank, or at least most, mostly that's how it works. At least I know that's for North America. This wasn't the case. You typically bought those higher positions.
Right.
And then, I mean, if you were successful at them, then you got to keep them. If obviously, if you were terrible, then you...
You died.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It was a way of getting rid of the worst of the upper class. What, but
leaders don't send their generals off into battle to die? Russia?
Yeah. You try not to take sides for...
I take side of this one.
We're definitely taking a side here.
Yeah.
I just meant like in general politics and religion and stuff. We're trying not to give our opinions. But Russia invading the Ukraine like it did the end of February is something that, if you've heard the last few podcasts, we've mentioned a little bit, and there may be more mentions of it in the future. Because when I'm talking about warfare... It comes up.
Mm-hmm.
The two consuls possessed equal power, which was basic to almost all Roman public offices. It served to check abuses of power because one official's actions could be obstructed by his colleague. So it seems like a sound system, which is probably why it lasted 500 years.
Mm-hmm.
Despite the advantages of having two people with equal power, there were emergency situations where one person in command worked better. In these cases, a dictator was chosen and had complete authority over civil and military matters, and he was unquestionable. Although this seems similar to the roles of a king, dictators of Rome were limited to serving a maximum 6-month term.
Hmm.
That's very short.
Yeah.
Contrary to the modern notion of a dictator as a usurper, Roman dictators were freely chosen, usually from the ranks of consuls. Contrary to the modern notion of a dictator as a usurper, Roman dictators were freely chosen, usually from the rank of consuls, during turbulent periods when one-man rule proved more efficient. The office was thoroughly constitutional and should not be confused with the late republican dictatorships of Sulla and Caesar, which were simply legalizations of autocratic power obtained through military usurpation. That will come up later. The Senate played the most important role in the Roman Republic for many reasons, including the fact that the consuls were drawn largely from its members, as I've already mentioned. Although the Senate may have existed under the monarchy, it served only as an advisory council for the king and had no real power. Its name suggests that it was originally composed of elderly men, senses, in Latin refers to elderly men, whose age and knowledge of traditions must have been highly valued in a pre-literate society. You didn't have books to look up information. You asked an elder.
Scrolls or tablets.
Or you asked an elder. During the Republic, the Senate was composed of members from the leading families. Its size during the early Republic is unknown, but ancient sources indicate that it numbered about 300 during the Middle Republic. During the Republic, the Senate advised both magistrates and the Roman people, although in theory the people were sovereign and the Senate only offered advice, in actual practice the Senate wielded enormous power because of the collective prestige of its members. It was summoned into session by an official, such as a consul, who submitted matters to it for discussion and debate. Whatever a majority voted in favor of was termed the Senate's advice, and these advisory decrees were directed to an official or the Roman people and mostly made into law. So it was the Senate who held the majority of the power. By around 300 BC, all real political power in Rome was centered in the Senate, which at the time included only members of the patrician and wealthy pleb families. So at least there were some plebs in there, but they were only the very wealthiest.
Wealthy families would probably be like almost middle class.
Well, upper middle class. we don't really have much for what patricians would be at that time in modern times. Mm-hmm. Like, we're talking royalty would be the equivalent of patricians. And most of the world does not have a lot of royalty. Yeah. And the wealthy pleb families would be commoners that managed to make themselves wealthy. So we're talking about most of the richest people in the world. I mean, like, we're talking Elon Musk.
Jeff Bezos.
Bill Gates.
Yes. Those would be the people, the commoners involved in the Senate. Yes. Class struggles. As I mentioned, politics, especially in the early republic, was dominated by struggles between the classes, the upper class patricians holding all the power in spite of their low population, and the lower class plebeians or plebs, the common people making up the majority of the population but having no power. In fact, in the early stages of Rome, the plebs had few rights at all. All of the government and religious positions were held by patricians. The patricians made the laws, owned the lands, and were the generals over the army. Plebs couldn't hold office and were not even allowed to marry patricians. So they revolted. The plebs revolt, starting around 494 BC, so this is actually very early on in the Republic, They began to fight against the rule of the patricians. They protested by going on strike. They would leave the city for a while, refuse to work, or even refuse to fight in the army. They made up the majority of the soldiers in the army, So this was a main problem. It left Rome without many everyday conveniences, but more importantly, it was in great danger because the majority of the army was gone. Now, this was probably the tipping point that made the Senate allow plebs a political office of their own. They started with two tribunes who had roles that were a lesser version of the consuls, but still considered holy and immune to criticism. They had the right to intercede on a citizen's behalf against the action of a consul, but their powers were only valid within the city proper. So if anything happened outside of the main area of the city, because Rome also expanded the city, right? Mm. So the city proper was basically just the main political areas, the very center. But yeah, if anything happened outside of that, they had no power. Although they were thought of as the champions of the people, persons elected to this office came from aristocratic families and generally favored the status quo. Nevertheless, the office could be and sometimes was used by young aspiring aristocrats to make a name for themselves by taking up populist causes in opposition to the nobility. Over the course of around 200 years, the plebs gained more rights, including the right to run for office and marry patricians. That's a long struggle, but at least they gained something out of it. 200 years.
Yeah, well, rights issues have been going on for a long time.
Yeah. In 450 BC, the first Roman law code was inscribed on 12 bronze tablets, known as the 12 Tablets, and publicly displayed in the Roman Forum. These laws included issues of legal procedure, civil rights, and property rights, and provided the basis for all future Roman civil law. So they didn't even have laws before this. It was just whatever the king said goes. And then, about 50 years into the Republic, they came up with some real laws. The Law of the 12 Tables is one of the earliest surviving codes of laws in the world, and was developed as a result of the class struggles to protect the legal, social, and civil rights of citizens. A commission of 10 men was appointed in 433 BC to write a code of law that was suitable for both parties. Before the 12 Tables Law, there were only private laws which applied to Roman citizens. The city of Rome had other conflicts, of course, some similar to ones we have today, such as with immigration. On a few occasions, entire groups of people were expelled from the city. Non-citizens, excluding slaves, were expelled on a couple of occasions, likely due to complaints from the citizens about them. Think of today. Oh, they're taking our job. They're very similar back in that time. The people were expelled from the city, and they lost whatever they couldn't carry with them. So if they had living space in the city, they just had to leave it behind. different ethnic groups and even professions such as astrologers and philosophers were also expelled on some occasions. You're a philosopher? Get out of our city.
Go philosophize in Greece, you weirdo.
Exactly. Warfare and expansion. It's important to note, especially when discussing the numerous wars, that many ancient Roman historians were extremely patriotic. And so they believed that Rome only fought just wars. Think just wars is in quotation marks. So this is similar to, this makes me think of the narrative Russia, especially Putin, the president of Russia right now. To the Russian people. They are liberating Ukraine and denazifying it, even though
they're not going to war. They're doing military movements.
Yeah, and they're killing thousands of civilians in addition to military. Anyways, the historians wrote their historic accounts according to their beliefs that Rome fought only just wars, and therefore distorting or suppressing facts that didn't fit this view. Modern historians highly doubt these one-sided views. In fact, only the fighting with the Gauls, which I'll talk about in a bit, clearly fits this narrative. The Gauls attacked them. So they started by defending themselves. But why did the Romans really fight if they weren't defending themselves or liberating people? Well, there are numerous reasons. But during the Republic, it was most likely due to the high importance placed on success in war. And of course, the huge amount of riches the city and individuals gained. Roman culture placed a high value on success in war, because that is when vitrus, which is courage and qualities of leadership, was displayed best. A parade through Rome celebrating a victory over an enemy was the honor most highly prized by the senatorial generals. As I mentioned earlier, the transition from a kingdom to a republic occurred while Rome was under attack. This time period is referred to as the Gallic War. Around 509 BC, various Gallic tribes were attacking Italy from the north as their culture spread throughout Europe. The Gauls vastly outnumbered the Romans, which led to the city of Rome being plundered and the Gauls leaving. The Roman Republic and Gauls remained at war intermittently for more than two centuries. Now, Gauls were people from Western Europe, primarily the area that's modern-day France.
Yes, and if you do happen to be in France, you probably know all about the Gauls with the cartoon Asterix and Obelix. Because it's all about there are a couple of Gauls who were fighting Romans.
Though the Gauls sacked and burned Rome in 390 BC, this is when Rome lost the majority of the records from earlier times, the Romans rebounded and eventually gained control of the entire Italian peninsula by 264 BC. This included a few wars between Rome and other Latin city-states, as well as the Etruscans. These would be wars like the Samnite Wars, Latin War, and Pyrrhic War. There was a lot of wars that all have special names, so I'll try to mention the names, but I'm not going to go into detail of all the wars. Rome then fought a series of wars known as the Punic Wars with Carthage, a powerful city-state in North Africa. This is where the infamous Hannibal comes in.
Oh, you mean Anthony Hopkins?
No, not that Hannibal.
Oh.
No, we're talking not Hannibal Lecter. We're talking Hannibal.
Hannibal Burris, the comedian. No.
No. Hannibal as in the ruler of Carthage.
Right. The elephant guy.
Yes. Hannibal was a Carthaginian military commander who was known as one of the best and most talented commanders in history. After the First Punic War, there was a temporary peace between Carthage and the Romans, as both economies were dependent on the Mediterranean Sea as a commercial trading route from eastern countries like Greece and Lebanon. After the death of Hannibal's father, Hannibal came to power and spent years preparing to defeat the Romans. In 218 BC, Hannibal invaded Italy, leading the Carthage army in its famous crossing of the Alps to attack Rome. But after almost 15 years of fighting, Hannibal was forced to retreat from Italy, leaving Rome in full control of Sicily, the Western Mediterranean, and much of Spain. But yes, this is the tale of Hannibal crossing the Alps on elephants. Yes. In the Third Punic War, which was 149 to 146 BC, a much shorter war, the Romans captured and destroyed the city of Carthage and sold its surviving inhabitants into slavery, making a section of North Africa a Roman province. At the same time, Rome also spread its influence east, defeating the kingdom of Macedon in Greece in Macedonian Wars and turning that kingdom into another Roman province. Rome fought a number of wars with the various Greek city-states during the time of the Republic, but its final and definitive occupation didn't occur until the end of the Republic, after the Battle of Actium in 31 BC, in which Augustus defeated Cleopatra VII, the Greek Queen of Egypt, and Mark Antony, the Roman general.
Antony and Cleopatra?
Yes.
Elizabeth Taylor?
I'm also going to point out that part of why Rome was successful in keeping the territories it gained through warfare was that each province was semi-independent, in that they had a local government in addition to the rule of Rome. Although the governors themselves were elected within the city of Rome and assigned a province to move to and govern, they did rely heavily on the local elites as mediators. Rome also built an extensive road system that facilitated communication across the ever-increasing, I'll say, empire in quotation marks because they weren't an official empire yet, but they were huge. Life in the Republic. Expansion brought Rome into contact with many diverse cultures. The most important of these was Greek, with its highly refined literature and learning. Rome responded to it with ambivalence. Although Greek doctrina was attractive, it was also the culture of the defeated and enslaved. Much Greek culture was brought to Rome in the aftermath of military victories, as Roman soldiers returned home not only with works of art, but also with learned Greeks who had been enslaved. Despite the ambivalence, nearly every facet of Roman culture was influenced by the Greeks, and it was this Greco-Roman culture that the Roman Empire bequeathed to later European civilization. As Roman aristocrats encountered Greeks, they learned to speak and write in their language, with many even doing correspondence in Greek. By the late Republic, it became standard for senators to be bilingual. Many were raised by Greek-speaking slaves and later tutored by Greek slaves or freedmen. Nonetheless, despite their increasing fluency in Greek, senators continued to insist on Latin as the official language of the government. Visiting dignitaries from the East, addressing the Senate in Greek, had their speeches translated as a mark of their subordination. Because Greek was the dominant language of the East, due to the Greek expansion and conquest prior to the Romans, Romans had to use Greek if they wished to reach a wider audience. Thus, the first histories by Romans were written in Greek. Prior to Greek influence, Rome had a folk tradition of poetry in the native Saturnian verse, but not a formal literature. While the influence of Greek high culture was felt primarily in a small circle of elite Romans, who had the wealth to acquire Greek art and slaves, and the leisure time and education to read Greek authors, the influence of religions from the Eastern Mediterranean was much wider, due in large part to state cults. Although Rome gained considerable wealth through its military conquests, certain fundamental features of the economy remained constant. From its founding to the fall of the empire, agriculture was the basis of the Roman economy, with as many as four-fifths of the population working the fields. As Rome expanded, this population became primarily slaves, so there was little to no reason for the Romans to improve farming technology. So they didn't.
Mm-hmm.
Most farming technology advancements came much later. By the end of the Republic, Italy was an extensive slave society, with best estimates being well over 1 million slaves. No census figures give the numbers of slaves, but slaveholding was more widespread and on a larger scale than in the antebellum American South. where slaves made up about one-third the population. In effect, Roman soldiers fought in order to capture their own replacements on the land in Italy. They fought to gain slaves that could then work their jobs. Fields. Yep. Although they didn't bother with farming technology, there were other technological advancements made during the Republic due to the ever-expanding population, although not many. One of the greatest technological achievements in all of Roman history occurred around 200 BC. This is a substance used in building. Guess what it is?
Concrete.
Yes. It was discovered that a wet mixture of crushed stone, lime, and sand would set into a material of great strength, this being concrete. This construction technique had great advantages over traditional cut stone technique. The materials were more readily available, concrete could be molded into desired shapes, and the molds could be reused for repetitive production. The new technology also permitted improvements in the construction of the aqueducts, needed to increase the city's water supply. The majority of Roman aqueducts were built during the Republic, with the first built in 312 BC, and construction continuing until roughly 226 AD. About 500 years of building aqueducts, but they started in the Republic.
I thought all ducts were aqua. Oh, aqueducts.
Aqueducts.
Right.
Those big, tall bridges for water, basically. Yeah. Late in the Republic, Rome saw a period of peace with its neighbors. But as Rome's conquests declined, so did their resources and sources of income. While aristocratic electoral competition was tradition during the Republic, over time it escalated in competitiveness that was later fatal to the Republic. For example, Publius Cornelius Scipio Africanus. Now that's a name, huh? Emerged from the Second Punic War as the Roman whose prestige far surpassed that of his peers. Nonetheless, a number of senators attacked him and his brother Lucius with legal charges until he finally retired from Rome to end his life at his Campanian villa. For younger senators, however, Scipio's spectacular achievement was something to emulate. Senators started challenging the system and winning seats and power even though they were underage or had already served their single allowed term. You'd asked about if they served more than one? Well, they started challenging the system and were successful.
Well, since they were the ones making the laws, why can't we change the laws?
Now, they did this primarily by pouring a fortune into pleasing the plebs with extravagant games so they won their vote. Mm-hmm. And by the late Republic, the vote of the commoners did matter. Even if it not officially, it was...
If there's less likely to be an uproar.
Yes, or an uprising, too.
Yes.
Rome's complex political institutions began to crumble under the weight of the growing empire, ushering in an era of internal turmoil and violence. With politicians set on reform ending up dead, the gap between rich and poor widened, as wealthy landowners drove small farmers from public land, while access to the government was increasingly limited to the more privileged classes. While the personal power of individual senators grew, it weakened the social control of the elite as a whole, and the poor had become too numerous to be controlled without changing the system. Many of the small farmers driven from their land moved to the cities and contributed to the steadily growing population. This density led to the miseries associated with big cities, which were exacerbated by absence of regulation. By 200 BC, the population density led to construction of three-story apartment buildings. Prior to this, there were only two.
And they're probably all walk-ups, too.
No, they weren't. Of course they're walk-ups, silly. They were constructed without a building code, so these structures were often unsound and prone to collapse. They were also often placed too close together and partly made of wood. They were tinderboxes ever ready to burst into flame. The population density also increased the vulnerability to food shortages and plagues. In general, Republican state developed few new institutions to manage the growing urban populations until the reign of Augustus. So we're talking a couple hundred years of awful living conditions. And with no police force, crime was out of control in Rome, and people feared for their safety. The wealthy hired their own private armies for protection. These armies grew large in some cases, and they owed allegiance to a private citizen, as opposed to the Roman government. It was within this changing atmosphere that military leaders such as Julius Caesar were able to seize control of and put an end to the Roman Republic. Julius Caesar. Gaius Julius Caesar was a man of many talents. Born into the patrician class, Caesar was intelligent, educated, and cultivated. An excellent speaker, he possessed a sharp sense of humor, charm, and personality. All of these traits combined helped make him a skilled politician. Moreover, Caesar was a military genius. His many successful military campaigns gained him broad support and popularity among the common people. Caesar also won the undying loyalty of his soldiers, who supplied him with the necessary muscle to seize power. Julius Caesar began his rise to power in 60 BC by forging an alliance with another general, Pompey, who was also his son-in-law, and a wealthy patrician, Crassus. Together, these three men assumed control of the Roman Republic, and Caesar was thrust into the position of consul. Historians have since dubbed this period of rule by these three men the First Triumvirate. Now, if you're researching this kind of thing, those terms come up a lot. So, over time, however, the triumvirate broke down. Crassus was killed in battle, and Pompey began entertaining ideas of ruling without the dangerously popular Caesar. Since his wife, Caesar's daughter, had died, he had no familial ties to Caesar anymore. While Caesar was fighting in Gaul, as I mentioned, modern-day France, Pompey and the Senate ordered Caesar to return to Rome without his army. But when Caesar crossed into northern Italy, he brought his army with him, in defiance of the Senate's order. This fateful decision led to a civil war. Caesar defeated Pompey's forces and entered Rome in 46 BC, triumphant and unchallenged. Now, why would Caesar come back and disobey order of the Senate? Gee, you think maybe, like, of course he knew that they were going to try to kill him or kick him out or something. Like, that just seemed like a very stupid political move. Oh yeah, come back, but don't bring your army. I think there was probably a better way to do that.
I'm not a military general, though, or a politician, so who knows.
Upon his return, Caesar made himself dictator and absolute ruler of Rome and its territories. During his rule, he enacted several reforms. Caesar founded many colonies in new conquered territories and provided land and opportunity for poor Romans who chose to migrate there. He reduced the number of slaves and opened citizenship up to people living in the provinces. Finally, he created a new calendar named the Julian calendar. This very calendar, with a few minor adjustments, is the same one used around the world today. The Senate made Julius Caesar dictator, but in their minds, it was their traditional dictator, who served for a limited of 6 months. Right? Remember that?
Yep.
Okay. However, Julius Caesar ordered them to make him dictator for life. So Caesar's actions threatened to end the Republic once and for all. Fearing this change, a group of senators plotted to and murdered Caesar on the Ides of March 44 BC. So approximately March 15th. The Ides of a month is just the middle of the month, so it could have been the 14th, 15th, 16th. Obviously, we don't know exact date, but it's typically considered March 15th.
As the Ides of March. How long after he became dictator did this happen?
About 2 years.
Okay. Well,
so he was dictator longer than others before him, yeah. But he didn't last very long.
No, but still, it's a good length for a dictatorship.
Yeah. Although the senators succeeded in ending Caesar's life, they did not realize that at the time, the Republic had died with them. There are a number of myths, mostly spread via pop culture, regarding Caesar's death.
Damn that Shakespeare.
First one is that Caesar's last words were, "Et tu, Brute," which meant, You too, Brutus?
In Latin. This was an invention of Shakespeare for his play.
And actually, I believe the pronunciation is Brute.
Brute? Okay.
I could be wrong, though.
I haven't read. I haven't actually read the play.
That's how I've always read it.
You too, Brute? Okay. In fact, Brutus and Caesar weren't actually that close. Caesar trusted Decimus much more, and Decimus worked alongside Brutus and Cassius in the assassination plot. So, if anything, his last words should have been, "A two, Decimus."
Which means, "You two, 10?" It's a precursor to 11. It's a Stranger Things prequel.
Second myth is that the soothsayer warning him to beware the Ides of March was another Shakespearean invention. However, it is based closer to the truth. Caesar was warned mid-February to be careful the next 30 days, although it wasn't a lucky prediction, rather a calculated assessment of Rome's political climate. The end date of the prophecy wasn't a coincidence either, because on March 18th, Caesar was going to embark on a multi-year military campaign that would take him away from Rome. The assassins had to kill him before he left. A third myth is that even though it was reported that as many as 60 senators participated in stabbing Caesar to death, he only received 23 wounds. Which, while still being a lot, it definitely doesn't fit the narrative that Game of Thrones copied, in which each person goes up to him, says something to him, and stabs him once. There weren't 60 stab wounds, but Game of Thrones definitely... You gotta admit that scene is definitely a play on the...
Yeah, but there also wasn't Caesar. 60
stab wounds
to I'm Mr. Just, Snow as well.
I just mean that's definitely taken from the death of Caesar. Mm-hmm. And four, the assassins ultimately failed to restore a meaningful republic to Rome. But it's not because they failed to win over the people. They failed to win over the soldiers. In his will, Caesar had the ancient equivalent of a poison pill, a massive payout to Roman citizens and soldiers, which fractured the support of the conspirators. The Roman Republic had been in trouble for nearly a century, ripped apart by civil wars and ruled by armies. Caesar used cash to consolidate his power even after death. In fact, since he was preparing to leave on a grand military campaign, his soldiers were gathered in and around the city at the time of his murder. Those soldiers wanted a significant payout from whoever was going to rule Rome, and Brutus and Cassius didn't pull it off in time to secure their support. After Caesar's death, Rome once again fell into political disarray, with a lot of fighting among the Senate for power and control. And again, I won't go into detail, but there were wars and a lot of scheming that ended with Caesar's nephew, adopted son, and heir, Octavian, who later changed his name to Augustus, beating all others to become Rome's first emperor. And this included him beating Antony and Cleopatra at war that I mentioned earlier, but I'm not going to go into detail because... Go into detail of that. There's just so many.
That's a podcast all on its own.
Yeah. Just, I have a couple extra little notes because I know you've been curious. Like, the term Caesar was the family name of Julius Caesar, but it later became a term meaning emperor, which is why emperors from Augustus onward are sometimes referred to as Caesar.
Right. Okay.
Also, yes, this is the time when Cleopatra ruled Egypt. Although she had a child with Julius Caesar and married Mark Antony, I'm choosing not to include her in this episode because she was a very minor character when you're looking at 500 years of Roman history. And the Cleopatra of the Roman Republic that we know was the seventh of that name. And so we could do an entire podcast on
just the name Cleopatra.
Yes. And lastly for me is my Simpsons reference. So last episode, I mentioned a Simpsons episode where the family visits an ancient Rome exhibit at a museum. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of references to ancient Rome in general. Nothing necessarily specific to either the kingdom or the republic. But
I did find some references to Julius Caesar. So in one of Julius Caesar is one of the many people on Ned's list of laudable lefties in Flanders' Book of Faith, the seventh book in the Simpsons Library of Wisdom series. In the Treehouse of Horrors 3, Homer's Halloween costume was Julius Caesar in the opening segment. In the comic Simpsons Save the World, it's 2194, and a tour guide takes us on a tour of the Simpsons Museum, where he says that Homer Simpson was more important than Socrates, Da Vinci, Gandhi, Einstein, Hawking, Julius Caesar, and Ryan Seacrest.
Okay, most of those I agree with, but Ryan Seacrest?
Yeah, I agree, but this is probably written. I didn't put down the date of this, but this was probably written at the high of
American Idol.
Yes. But that is all I have for Roman Republic, which is a lot, I know, but not as much as it could have been, trust me.
Yeah. Well, and I actually found quite a few movies and TV series about the Republic, starting with, in 1964, The Hero of Rome. Also in 1964, Coriolanus, Hero Without a Country. 1963, Brennus, Enemy of Rome. You might recognize this name. Scipio Africanus, The Defeat of Hannibal. That's a movie that came out in 1937. Jupiter's Darling in 1955. There's actually two movies called Hannibal, not the one with Anthony Hopkins, that came out in 1959 and one in 2006.
That are actually about the Hannibal about of Hannibal. Carthage, yes. Instead of yeah. Hannibal Lecter.
Right. And then Scipio the African in 1971.
Ah, so you recognize the name.
Yeah, I did recognize the name. I wasn't too sure how to pronounce it, so thank you.
Well, that doesn't mean I pronounce it right.
The Centurion in 1961. There was a TV miniseries that came out. I think actually it might be on Netflix. It's called Ancient Rome, The Rise and Fall of an Empire. Two of the episodes, one of them is about Caesar. That's episode one. And another one is episode four. It's called Revolution. That came out in 2006. There's a Russian movie called Spartak. It came out in 1926. An Italian movie, Spartaco, that came out in 1953. Spartacus came out in 1960 and 2004. Yes.
Yes. I was actually... That is something that happened during the Republic, is Spartacus led an uprising of slaves in 73 BC. But I couldn't find exactly where to fit that in, especially since there were multiple uprisings and things like that. But it is an important...
And then there was a series of Spartacus movies. One was Blood and Sand in 2010, The Gods of the Arena in 2011, Vengeance in 2012, and War of the Damned in 2013. So they were probably just straight-to-video movies.
But. Yes. But the original Spartacus...
Kirk Douglas. Yep.
Yes, I had that movie. At least I had it on VHS, which, yes, I know, that makes me old, but...
Yeah, old. In 1914 was the very first movie I found about Julius Caesar, and the title was Gaius Julius Caesar.
Even though Shakespeare's play...
This is a movie.
Yes, I know, but I just... Like, I would have thought...
Movies weren't around much before then.
That's true. 1914 was very early. Yeah, you're right. Okay.
Like, I'm sure there's many productions of it.
That's true, yeah.
Caesar Against the Pirates in 1962. Caesar the Conqueror in 1962. 1962, big year for Caesar. The Giants of Rome in 1964. Julius Caesar, 1950, 1953, 1970, and 2002. Druids in 2001. Empire, 2005. Roman Empire, Reign of Blood, in 2018. Anthony and Cleopatra, in 1908, 1972, 1974, and 1981.
Yeah, those probably include more of the backstory of how Caesar was involved and stuff like that, instead of just...
And then there's Cleopatra... 1917, 1928, 1934, 1963, 1999, and 2007. It's been made a couple times.
But one thing is, they're also probably all of the Cleopatra that we know, who is Cleopatra the VII.
Yeah, Elizabeth Taylor.
Which is something that I didn't even know before going into the podcast.
I didn't know that until you told me.
I didn't know she was Cleopatra the VII, so it kind of makes me interested to go do some research and find out more about previous Cleopatras.
In 1945, Caesar and Cleopatra. 1953, The Servant of the Nile. 1962, A Queen for Caesar. 1964, Carry On Cleo. 1968, Asterix and Cleopatra. Asterix is...
Yeah, that cartoon, the cartoon. We were talking about.
1983, The Cleopatras. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right, but anyway, that's... Now, we're going to get a whole bunch of these Asterix and Obelix. Asterix and Obelix, Mission Cleopatra, 2002. Asterix at the Olympic Games in 2008. Asterix and Obelix versus Caesar, 1999. Asterix and Obelix, God Save Britannia in 2012. The Centurion in 1961. Carmen Sandiego's Great Chase Through Time, 1999. That's a video game. She goes back to the Republic. Age of Empires, Definitive Edition, in 2018. Civilization VI, in 2016. The Forgotten City, in 2021. Asterix, for the Sega Genesis, in 1991. Spartan, Total Warrior, in 2005. Grand Aces, Rome, 2009. Centurion, Defender of Rome, in 1990. And of course, Assassin's Creed Origins in 2017.
And those are the last ones, the Republic?
Yeah.
Not just the Empire?
Not just the Empire at all.
Wow, that's impressive.
Those have the Republic in them.
Mostly probably because of Caesar.
Yes. Yeah, so it's probably just the end of the Republic.
Yeah, the very, very end of the Republic.
5 years, the last 25 years.
Yeah.
But yeah, and that's about all I could find for that. There's probably going to be a lot more next week or next podcast, just because...
Well, and plus there's a lot of references that we won't catch necessarily because they're not... If it's something we don't watch, like with Game of Thrones, that death scene, which I'm giving it away, but at the same time...
Don't worry, it comes back to life, spoilers.
Yeah, I mean, when Jon Snow is stabbed and by his fellow Knights of the Watch.
Yeah.
It's obviously a reference to Julius Caesar being stabbed by his fellow senators. But if you look for references to Roman Republic or even references to Caesar in pop culture, you're not going to find that. You're going to find things that have the name Caesar in the title or the name.
Actually, you can narrow it down to Julius Caesar.
Yes, but not... A description of that Game of Thrones episode is not going to include...
No.
Saying that... Yeah. That's what I mean.
So there's a lot of references. If anyone has any other references that they can think of that I didn't mention, let me know. And I'll bring it up in a future podcast.
Yeah, like a little more obscure references, like I said, with the Game of Thrones one I came up with, which, I mean, they're probably out there, especially if you have, you know, Star Trek, Star Wars, Doctor Who ones that we haven't thought of, then definitely let us know.
Yes.
Our email again is diggingdeeperwiththeancients@gmail.com.
Our Instagram and Facebook are at Digging Deeper with the Ancients, and our Twitter is Digging Deep Pod. So get a hold of us, talk to us. Don't forget to like, share, subscribe, and we'll see you for part three.
Yes, part three, the Roman Empire. That's going to be a tough one.
All right, and we'll see you all then.
Bye.